Thanks very much. I'm Michal Friedhoff. I think everyone else who spoke today had a fairly clearly defined role. Congress is never that way. So I figured I would start by just giving you a sense of what our staff did during the spell and what Congressman Markey, what his role was throughout the spell. I've worked on his staff for most of the past 15 years, and it's not atypical for us to have five or six PhD scientists, most of us AAAS fellows or former AAAS fellows on staff. So we had some geologists, we had some reproductive biologists, I'm a chemist by training. We had a seafood or sort of an oceanographer at the time. And very early on in the BP spill, Congressman Markey asked us to basically dig in and look at every aspect of it. So we basically lived it for 4 months. For many of us, that's pretty much all we did. We stopped doing anything else. And most of that work was done through the congressman's chairmanship of the Subcommittee on Energy and Environment of the House Commerce Committee, which he chaired at the time. We probably held a dozen hearings and briefings. Some of them just featured scientists and didn't have, you know, company officials or even government officials at them. We explored everything from plumes to flow rate to blowout protector designs. We had one hearing on the oil budget and seafood safety that we called very quickly in August in the middle of the congressional recess. Congressman Markey was the only member of Congress present. He spent, I think, 90 minutes just doing question and answers with federal and non-federal scientists that we had brought in for that hearing. We sent dozens of very lengthy and very technical oversight letters and reviewed thousands of pages of documents, some of which have never been made publicly available. And we also spoke on a daily basis with the country's best scientists and engineers in all of these areas as we developed legislation that ranged from better dispersant testing to spill technology R&D to blow-up preventer standards to spill response plans. And it was very clear to us, based on these interactions, that the country really does have a very deep reservoir of expertise in this area. At the same time, it was also very clear to us that there were significant gaps in the science and technology that was needed to address the spill. And basically what that amounted to was a collective failure of imagination on the part of both Congress and the executive branch. Because when it implemented the Oil Pollution Act, you know, maybe we solved a lot of problems that the Exxon Valdez spill exposed. But that's where sort of the contemplation of the realm of the possible kind of stopped. Even as the oil and gas industry started drilling in deeper and deeper waters in riskier and riskier conditions. So just kind of going through the laundry list, some of the other speakers have talked to a little bit about what we think was missing. First and foremost, a major knowledge gap with major policy implications was the flow rate of the oil itself. Now, the oil companies are actually required to use the federal government's spill trajectories when they calculate the potential impacts of a spill from their wells. But at the time of the spill, none of those trajectories included a subsurface prolonged blowout. So right from the get-go, every single spill response plan submitted to the government by industry said that oil was never going to wash ashore because the worst-case scenario was, 4,700 barrels of oil. Nothing bad would happen. And all of those cookie-cutter oil response plans also, of course, included the famous plan to protect the walruses that live in the Gulf of Mexico. So pretty clear, no one's made spill response a priority, but even had they done so, the government's own data just didn't even really think about this. Now, after the spill started, the first estimate that we had was 1,000 barrels of oil per day. When the government raised that estimate to 5,000 barrels of oil per day, BP argued with that. They spent a day saying, no, we think it's about 1,000. In early May, we had a briefing, and we had a BP engineer on the phone. He was calling in from Louisiana, and Congressman Markey asked him, what do you think the worst case oil flow rate is? And he said, 60,000 barrels. which is about what the federal government eventually concluded it probably was. And in response to some of our data requests from BP, we found internal BP documents that also estimated a much higher flow rate than what BP was sort of saying publicly in the press. And the thing is, of course, they have a liability interest in minimizing the flow rate estimates because they're penalized per barrel spilled. So BP consistently downplayed any assertion that there was more oil than anyone thought. So then a couple weeks in, there was a short little clip of the underwater cameras that showed up on YouTube. And BP said, no, we cannot possibly make our live feeds public. Can't do it. It would crash our servers, and there was this big back and forth between our office and BP about that. And finally we said, well, you know what? You can use our servers. And so finally, you know, having no real exit, they said, okay. And ultimately, the spill cam was born. And that became rapidly the visual symbol of the spill, and the emotional symbol of the spill, too, I would say. It was viewed by millions. And the word spill cam was actually coined the 2010 word of the year by an organization. I forget which one. But by the time the administration realized the potential size of the spill, and also perhaps that it wasn't really getting what it needed from BP by way of information, and set up its flow rate technical group, it was about a month in. So, and it's our view that in that month, had there been more knowledge about what the extent was, they could have saved some time and taken different steps. You know, would they have ever tried a top hat? I don't really think so. If they had known, you know, 60,000 barrels per day is the likely scenario. And we certainly agree with the BP Commission with their conclusion that there really needs to be a permanent federal scientific flow rate group within the federal government just to kind of maintain this capacity so that the next time we'll be more prepared to make quicker estimates. And the second area where engineering capacity was missing is in oil spill containment. It took 87 days to cap the well. And as I said earlier, maybe if we'd known more information about the flow rate, that they might have been able to skip a few missed opportunities or skip a few wrong turns, I guess, and gotten to capping the thing a little earlier. But we were really struck that a lot of the same technologies that were being tried to cap the well in Macondo were exactly the same as what had been used in Ixtoc decades earlier. Third, we saw that the use of dispersants was basically a giant ocean experiment in real time. Because no one had really thought about using dispersants for months, stretching out over many life cycles of impacted plants and animals. No one had ever thought about using them deep underneath the ocean surface. No one had thought about their impact on deep sea life. No one had really thought about vast plumes of dispersed oil to be floating underwater. And no one had really thought about how one might detect the presence of dispersants in seafood. That was a test that was developed months after the spill. By FDA in order to kind of regain public confidence in seafood safety. But it didn't exist before the spill. And the extent of a fourth area where knowledge is clearly needed is still unfolding as we're seeing what the results of the forensic examinations of the blow-up preventer and the cementing and the well design tests were. And, you know, early on, as we were reviewing documents, I think all of us felt like there was a careless disregard for safety, the use of time-saving shortcuts. You know, everyone, you know, centered in or focused in pretty quickly on the number of centralizers in the well being 7 instead of 21. Everyone looked at the cement formula and the cement tests that hadn't worked. There was talk about blowout preventers with dead batteries or, you know, disconnected controllers, and all of those things probably happened. But recently, the federal government's contractor came out with a report that seems to suggest the blowout preventers themselves may be fundamentally unable to work in an actual blowout. Because basically what it found was that the force of the blowout kind of shoved the pipe off center, rendering it uncuttable and unsealable. So the whole idea of a blowout preventer as being a fail-safe device that will fix all the problems if everything else fails obviously needs to be completely re-examined. And, of course, it goes without saying, and many of the other speakers have addressed this, that the reason why all of these things matter is that we don't yet know the full impact of the oil spill on the environment, the food web, the plant and animal populations that could have been impacted, or really where the fate of the oil ended up, you know, what the fate of all the oil was in the first place. And it may take years before we know all those answers. So that's sort of a look at where we think the science and engineering gaps are. But there was a lot more about the spill that revealed something about the way science informs or doesn't inform policy decisions. And as I mentioned, I've been on the Hill for most of the last 15 years, and I cannot recall another time where science was literally unfolding on center stage real time at our hearings in a 24/7 news cycle for months on end. But, you know, you've got an intense nature of the problem, and you've got an intense interest in the problem, but you also have some real limitations. First of all, as I think we've heard, the administration was forced to make policy decisions based on what it knew at any given time. And for decisions like how much dispersant to use or whether to attempt a top hat or a junk shot, those decisions were limited severely, I think, by what it didn't know about the actual flow rate. You know, and we saw all kinds of assertions that were based on the best available knowledge at the time, like, for example, the assertion that there was no oil on the seafloor, only to see those same assertions, you know, blown up really then several weeks later by pictures of oil on the seafloor. And that's a pretty, you know, that's a pretty hard situation for the decision makers to be in, I think. The press was reporting on everything. We saw some scientists press release their results before the results were peer reviewed, because of the urgency of the situation and because they felt that it was important to get the information out there. But what you ended up with were basically dueling papers on things like whether there were plumes. You know, so one day you'd have one eminent group saying, hey, look, plumes, huge, everywhere. And the very next day, someone else would say, no, we didn't see anything. And when you went and read the papers, you would find that the two groups were looking in different places over different time periods, and maybe they were actually both right. But that's not how it came through in the press. The press, you know, played it up as a dispute, an argument. There was disagreement. We also saw bad science. We had people coming to tell us about their magical oil remover machines. We saw people who were convinced that every dead bird, fish, turtle that existed in the Gulf had been poisoned by oil, even if they had no data to support that claim. There are people in the Gulf who believe that every health problem suffered by their family members, friends, neighbors, coworkers is a direct result of exposure to oil or dispersants. And to this day, there are people calling our office asserting completely unequivocally that the federal government is clearly still using dispersants because they saw some orange water and an empty Corexit container somewhere. And there's nothing you can say to them to convince them that this is probably not the case. So motivation and policy goals also cited science in both productive and counterproductive ways. We've heard some about the way the oil budget report was messaged by some within the administration. We saw state government officials insisting that the sand berms would stop the oil. We saw other state officials insisting that the administration was deliberately refusing offers of international assistance, even though there was no evidence to support either of those claims. There was plenty of science to refute just about anything that anyone could say. So as a result, what you have played up in the press and on Capitol Hill is filled with conflict and uncertainty, like most science really is. But what that ended up doing is causing a lot of second-guessing and undermining, I think, some public confidence in what people were doing. And that's sort of the very nature of science. It's organic. The knowledge evolves as theories are refined, proved, and disproved. But that process, I think, fed into conspiracy theories and left people in the Gulf and maybe nationwide feeling much less confident in what the federal response was. So what's next? Well, the Presidential Spill Commission came to very similar conclusions after a truly excellent report and series of white papers. And the administration has implemented some of those recommendations, is working on others, and needs legislative authority for the rest. So in the last Congress, Congressman Markey and others passed legislation through the House that addresses most of the safety and spill response issues and has reintroduced that legislation in this Congress. But instead, today and next week on the House floor, House Republicans are almost certain to reject that language and instead are passing out some bills that basically grandfather in pre-spill environmental analysis that say the worst-case spill is 4,700 barrels per day. Deem drilling permits to be approved within 60 days if the Department of Interior hasn't acted on them, kind of no matter what, and opens up vast areas of the Outer Continental Shelf to new drilling. So it's unclear to me whether, you know, what the Senate will do, if it will do anything, and whether consensus is achievable here. But rather than end on a completely pessimistic note, I will instead say that while the BP spill did expose many failures of imagination and regulatory gaps, I really do believe that what was learned during and in the months after the spill will inform our future drilling activities and scientific understanding. And ultimately, that is, you know, a positive outcome associated with a tragic circumstance. And with that, I'd welcome any questions.
I know you have questions.
I'll start, and we'll go from there. The problem is, as you point out, maybe actually a little more complex than it need to be, but by the very nature. Oil spill R&D from the agency perspective can be done in, I'll call it, three different ways. One is using directly appropriated money to carry out the missions of the agency. And so, and over that period of time, there's some amount of that, and that has actually come out in some reports. The second would be some sort of directly appropriated fund that was designed specifically and noted for R&D. And I hesitate to use the word earmark, but it's a directed fund as opposed to part of the general appropriation to do a specific task. Actually, our agency several years back, for 3 years running, had some of that in coordination with the University of New Hampshire and the Coastal Response Research Center, and used that money and developed a number of initiatives, including the one that turned out to be the Environmental Response Management Application, IRMA, and the GeoPlatform, the thing I showed you on there. But you would have to look at that period of history of where that happened, and that was not that frequent. The third way is a number of agencies, Coast Guard, EPA, former MMS, get a direct appropriation out of the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund every year. And they use that for any number of things, including research and development, training, and actually having paid people ready to respond. Our particular agency doesn't get that direct appropriation. But of the agencies that do, you will see every year in the appropriation from Congress, you'll see a line item that'll say Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund and that amount of money. So it's pretty easy to track. What's harder to track is what percentage of that funded activities related to oil spill response versus research and applied research or research and development. So it may have been used for funding personnel, funding laboratory work for EPA, doing exercises for the Coast Guard, or in some cases, one of the big appropriations has been for BOMER to run the OMSET test facility. So in a sense, that test facility is a research and development facility. So do you call the operation of that all research and development, even though a lot of companies and international groups come in and do their research there? And those results many of those results are made public. So I think that it becomes a very challenging group, and I know Congress has asked that same question, and to the extent that we've reported out how that's broken out. But I'll leave you with at least the knowledge that you could see from how much from the appropriated funds, the directed funds, and from the oil spill lobby trust fund. And you will see that that number was higher post-Exxon Valdez and progressively lower with time. And even if it remained constant, for as it did for some agencies, it had less buying power 20 years later than it did earlier on because of what it had, inflation and personnel.
And I have nothing to add there other than there have been some efforts to revitalize, especially the third area that he mentioned, the Oil Spill Liability Trust Fund money, and to include other agencies and to add different missions into that program. But none of those have been enacted yet.
I'd like to get the panel's feeling or response to another option, a slightly different option that is not without precedent, which is to take the $5 to $20 billion that is going to come in and fine money, and instead of that going into the federal treasury and being in some kind of federal trust fund and funding federal agencies to do things, actually put that in a separate trust fund that will be held in perpetuity to fund science related directly to the impacts of BP and how to respond to these kinds of incidents in the future. And the precedent I speak of, and maybe Terry, with your experience in Prince William, you might be familiar with this, but if I'm not mistaken, Congress stepped in after Exxon Valdez and actually established this.
Well, after the settlement, yeah.
After the settlement.
That trust fund to this day, if I'm not mistaken, since Moat and the National Wildlife Federation had a conference on this down in Sarasota, we had folks from up in Alaska, is still funding to this day.
Yeah.
Science and research, but it essentially is not a government entity; it's a non-government entity. So, I'd appreciate your thoughts on that.
Well, let me just start with the recommendation that we made on the commission, and that was that. As far as the Clean Water Act penalties, which could be substantial, as several people have already noted, because it's based on the amount of oil spilled into the water on a daily basis and then can go up or down based upon the degree of negligence, we've recommended that 80% of those proceeds go back to the Gulf. I think from a political as well as equitable standpoint that's the right thing to do, but it requires congressional action. And clearly there's also a need for directing some funds and resources towards the science and research that's necessary. But I'll tell you, the bulk of the money needs to go back to the Gulf for restoration. There's a serious problem. It's been going on now for decades. And here's an opportunity to put some meaningful resources towards addressing that problem.
If I could just quickly follow up on that. Many of us have concern, though, that what's needed is not taxpayer funds long-term, which is what's going to – you're going to have a long-term program, and you can't keep coming back to the federal government for taxpayer funds to do this. So if that money, the 80% that money, were to go into a trust fund, and that principal, the interest from that principal is what will fund the science forever from that. As opposed to many of us in the science community are concerned, you're going to get this slug of money coming in down there. Mm-hmm. Everybody is going to just, trying to think of a diplomatic way to say,
salivate.
Piss it away. But if bricks, mortars, equipment, that money will be gone in 5 years. And then where are we? We're right back to where we were. So I come back to this trust fund concept. I like the 80%.
I will defer to the other panelist. Anybody care to opine on that one? Okay. Well,
I think there's a decent level of support for Gulf restoration funds. I don't think there's support for 80% of those mines going back to R&D. I just don't. There could be support for some, though.
Yeah, I can't speak to what Congress is going to do, but. That is the real challenge, because there are going to be funds generated from civil penalties in the Clean Water Act, and historically that money's gone back to the General Treasury. So it's not without precedent that would be done, and they would have to change that precedent. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think that's not an administration's call right now.
Right. Got the question here.
I'm struck by the fact that every few years we tend to do this type of thing. We tend to be fairly good about fixing yesterday's problem. Now we know how to do levees in New Orleans, and I think we could do a better job of building nuclear reactors in Japan, and now we're going to solve this problem. Every few years we're here. It's just kind of a big question. How can we keep from doing this over and over again with whatever the next crisis is going to be? Any insights?
Well, let me start with that, because let me start with that, because I think that question's been brought up a number of times, and one of the things that post Exxon Valdez that they did, they did a lot of stuff, but I'll divide it generally into two areas. One was a regulatory regime that changed the way that double hull ships, the training for mariners, et cetera. So there were a number of things that came out as a regulatory practice and process that. One would argue that because we were having those events every 7 to 10 years, and we haven't had one in 20, that they probably had some impact, and that even with more ships on the ocean, they're doing a better job, so it had some impact. The second area, though, is more of that soft area, and it's designed that for any disaster management, and I want to specifically put in oil spills in a different category, that you prepare and train. You have plans and you practice those plans with the idea that you don't know what that next disaster is going to be or where it's going to be, but you know how you're going to respond as a unit, as a group, and you practice like that. Ideally, you're practicing for something that kind of happens. And if you're faced with this one where you're trying to use new technology and science, you really hadn't played that one out too well. So that becomes a problem. The reason oil spills are different, though, and this is, again, inherent from the Clean Water Act and then Exxon Valdez, is a large burden was put on because Congress at that time said, this is an industry responsibility. You are responsible. You're going to clean up. And we can sort out later whether it was all your fault or maybe it was a combination of you and Halliburton, Transocean. But you are the responsible party. You're going to be liable, and you need to be prepared. So you need to have your plans. You need to have access to equipment. You need to have stockpiles of dispersant. We talked about that a little earlier and why they all use Corexit primarily because it had an unlimited shelf life, and so they could store it around the world and all the companies could have access to it. But you're going to have that ability, and you're going to make it work. And so if you do that, then the expectation is if you have appropriate oversight, when the time comes, it all works like clockwork. If they practiced for something that wasn't, or they didn't practice for that reality, or they weren't fully prepared, or they had slacked off, then I think we get back to the genesis of your question of how do you deal with it when it's that low probability, high consequence event that hasn't happened. What level of effort can you put into it?
I think saying it's low probability, maybe looking at it the wrong way. It's low frequency. Low probability, I think, lulls people into a false sense of security that it's not going to happen. It's low frequency. It's going to happen. It just won't happen all that often. And the other point is, I don't know what the answer to your question is. It was a failure of imagination. It's the Army that is forever preparing for the last war, and that's what we had here. Now, we knew something like this could happen. The oil spills don't only just happen from tanker collisions or tankers running aground, and we've had this in the past, and it was complacency, and it was truly a lack of imagination.
I can't answer your question directly, but I think your question is most important. It's been very frustrating for the many years I've been involved in this not to be able to get the kind of approach to education that just cried out for. I think you said it just perfectly. This is an event that people pay attention to, kids pay attention to. This is an opportunity to get a literate public that can really be responsive to these issues, and we just, whether because of the bureaucratic thing of, well, it's when we did environmental health stuff, it was EPA would do Ranger Rick, but they're not interested in health. That's NIH. NIH wasn't interested in the Ranger Rick kind of thing, and you basically don't get the agencies to work together in any sort of comprehensive way to do what's needed.
How did that all work? Do you think in the end that you did direct things in a constructive way? Did you make a difference in what the agencies were doing? And how was the relationship? Was it harmonious or not?
I think we did. I think on flow rate, we were focused on flow rate from the very beginning, and I think before many others were. And I think a lot of what we did on flow rate, getting those images public, but even just the discussion of what the flow rate was probably did highlight the need to have that information. I think on the dispersant side, we did a lot of work related to what the thought process should be at the federal agencies. And I think if you look at kind of the oversight work that came out of our committee, it was often followed by statements by the executive branch, which is not to say the executive branch wasn't doing any of this work without us, but I do think that shining the public light on things sometimes speeds things up, sometimes focuses the public relations arm of an agency, and sometimes if there's voices, I know, you know, just looking at the interagency correspondence, for example, between EPA and the Coast Guard, there was not unanimity within the executive branch on what to do about dispersants. And EPA was consistently raising concerns about the amount of dispersants that were being used. And Coast Guard was saying, you know what, it's my job to keep it off the beach. Don't so much care what happens when it's in the ocean, you know? And that's really, you know, that's what these emails really were. It was EPA saying, wait a minute, that's not what we agreed to. Why are you, you know, we agreed that this would only, that you would only be using, authorizing the use of dispersants in, you know, under rare circumstances. In why is rare every single day? And so I think sometimes when Congress kind of said, yeah, why is rare every single day? I think that sometimes gave a louder voice to some within the executive branch. I do think there were other times when it wasn't harmonious. Certainly some people within the executive branch were not thrilled when we questioned whether the absence of knowledge on flow rate could be impacting the federal response. And that discussion, you know, really went on for months and sort of still is going on in correspondence for months. So
I really appreciated your plug for the AAAS fellows.
So let me add on to that in a way that while it is never, I won't say it's never pleasant, but while it's a little bit concerning sometimes when you're sitting on the other side of the bench and getting questioned, and which happened a couple times during the event, even for myself, I think if I took off my NOAA hat and said, I'm a taxpayer, I expect Congress to do this. I expect Congress to say, you know, my citizens are concerned. This is an area, an issue that's important to the country. Now, I will also tell you, I can't speak for every agency. I can only really speak not even for NOAA, but for my particular office. But I don't think that we were, I think there were several times when they were looking at holding a hearing and wanting to get the right people there, and they really did work with us. You know, we were very responsive, but it wasn't this oppressive beast, if you will. Congress says, show up, we're going to grill you. They basically said, no, we want this area, we want to discuss, we want to get your right people there to talk about it, and let's coordinate a time and that works so it doesn't impact the operations. And I think something else that was unique in this bill, which I had not ever seen before, is that on a daily basis, we had a congressional call every day, in the beginning even on weekends, but in as it went on, every weekday, and then it went to a shorter time span after the well was capped. But every single day, the agencies got on the phone, any members of Congress or their staff got on the phone, and we went through a briefing of the activities, what to expect, the weather forecast, and then opened it up for questions. And I think that went a long way in having a better understanding by congressional staff of issues that I brought up, like the loop current and flow rate and others. And some of those really did rise to the level that needed to be discussed in open forum and hearing. But these conversations would go sometimes no more than usually an hour, sometimes later on half hour, but sometimes it went even over an hour of questions. And I think that showed the level of interest nationwide that this bill had reached. And I really applaud both the administration and Congress for making that happen and having that work. I think that's something the public may not really have known about, but really, really helped with answering and addressing a lot of uncertainty during the middle of this bill.
And I completely agree with that. It was the first time that I'd seen an administration do that and release as many reports and documents and everything else in kind of real time before. So I agree, there was enormous, and there was really good communication a lot of the time.
I think that's going to probably be the last word, because we're at the end of our session. Thank you, panelists. I want to thank the audience for sticking with us on this marathon session.